Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're in Belt's Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2026. Members present are Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in recognizing and welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Doug Bridges. We have two items on our agenda today, Senate Bill 256, EMS Licensure Compact, and House Bill 110, Social Work Licensure Compact. First, we'll take up Senate Bill 256. With us for a presentation of the bill, we have the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Rob Myers, and his staff, Aaron Raybuck. Gentlemen, welcome. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I am Robert Myers, Senator for District Q. Joining me today is my intern, Aaron Raybuck. We're going to be presenting Senate Bill 256, the Emergency Medical Services Compact. Emergency medical services personnel operate on the front lines of public safety for us as Alaskans. No matter what sort of emergency they're responding to, they are the individuals we rely on when minutes and seconds matter. In a state like Alaska, with vast distances and many remote communities, that challenge can be even more pronounced. I do want to mention that this legislation was brought to us by the Department of Health in part because it is connected to the Rural Health Transformation Program that is moving through right now. But that is not the heart of the issue for this bill. At its core, SB 256 is about workforce mobility. Right now, emergency medical services personnel are licensed state by state. Even though Alaska uses some nationally recognized standards, these personnel often must go through multiple licensing processes to practice across state lines. That can create friction at times when we need it the most. SB 256 addresses that by allowing Alaska to join the Recognition of EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. This compact creates a privilege to practice model where qualified EMS licensed in one member state can practice in another while remaining under the authority and oversight of their home state and subject to Alaska law while operating here. This does not give up Alaska's control. The state retains full authority over licensure, discipline, and scope of practice. We can still restrict or revoke a provider's ability to operate here if necessary, and the compact strengthens information sharing between states, strengthening accountability and patient safety. This is important, especially during time periods of natural disasters, particularly for wildfires. During the summer, we often have wildfire crews come up here from down in the States. They bring their crews up to Alaska with their medical personnel already attached. Later on in the year, during the fall, after our fire season is calmed down, our fire crews often go down to the western states to fight their fires. We send our personnel down as well with our medical personnel. So this would help the transition in both directions during wildfire season. So during wildfire season, major accidents, or other large-scale emergencies, Alaska may have to rely on surge capacity that would bring in qualified personnel quickly to meet demand. This compact helps remove administrative barriers so that help can arrive faster and get to work immediately. SB 256 strengthens public safety, supports our workforce, and improves our ability to respond to emergencies. After all, we want our EMTs focused on patients, not on patients while waiting for paperwork. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, if you're ready, I have Mr. Raybuck here ready to go through the sectional, and then we have some invited testimony, I believe, that should be online. We've got Donnie Woodyard, with the Interstate Commission for the EMS Compact. We've got Justin Perkins from the Interior Region EMS Council. In the room, we've got Thomas Hatley, fire chief from our local Juneau Fire Department here, and then should have Brian Webb available from the Division of Public Health as well. So,
thank you, Senator Myers. Mr. Raybuck.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Raybuck, staff to Senator Myers. All briefly speak to the sectional analysis for SB 256. There are three major sections to this bill, and I'll go through each of them quickly. Section 1 of the bill requires the Department of Health to implement the EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. Section 2 is the meat and potatoes of the legislation. It adopts the full text of the Interstate Compact into Alaska statute. Within Section 2, the compact is organized into 15 subsections, which I'll walk through in a concise and hopefully compact manner. Within this block, Section 1 establishes the purpose, and Section 2 provides definitions. Section 3 outlines the concept of home state licensure, and Section 4 establishes the privilege to practice framework. Sections 4 and 5 make clear that Alaska retains full control over licensure, discipline, and scope of practice. The state may restrict or revoke a provider's privilege to practice here, and Section 8 establishes the framework for adverse actions and reporting requirements between member states. Section 6 addresses the relationship with the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, or EMAC, clarifying that EMAC provisions prevail during a declared emergency if there is a conflict. Section 7 provides for expedited licensure recognition for military members, veterans, and their spouses. Sections 9 through 11 address enforcement and coordination, including state authority to issue orders, the creation of the Interstate Commission in Section 10, and the development of a coordinated licensure and disciplinary database in Section 11. Sections 12 through 14 establish rulemaking procedures, oversight, dispute resolution, and the process for withdrawal or amendment of the compact. Section 15 explains how the compact should be interpreted and ensures that if one part is found invalid, the rest remains in effect. And this wraps up the main portion of the bill. And finally, Section 3 simply sets an effective date of January 1st, 2027. And this concludes the sectional analysis. Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Raybuck. Are there any questions from committee members for the bill sponsor or his staff? Seeing and hearing none, Senator Myers has provided for us an invited list of testifiers. We will go to them now. First up is Mr. Donnie Woodyard. Mr. Woodyard, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. Mr. Woodyard.
He's not here.
Okay. Next up, we will go then to Mr. Justin Perkins, who is with us here in person. Mr. Perkins, are you on the phone? Okay. We will go then to Mr. Tom Hatley. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Tom Hatley, Juneau Fire Chief. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Hatley. I serve as the Fire Chief for Capital City Fire and Rescue here in Juneau. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of Senate Bill 256 and the EMS Compact. From the operational standpoint, Alaska presents unique challenges when it comes to delivering emergency medical services. Our geography, weather, and limited workforce create real barriers to maintaining consistent ambulance staffing and response capability. In many communities, including Juneau, we are already working within tight staffing margins, and when vacancies are unexpected, absences occur, these impacts are felt immediately. The EMS Compact provides a practical and responsible solution to one of those challenges. It allows qualified EMS providers, such as EMTs and paramedics, to move across state lines more efficiently without delays associated with obtaining multiple state licenses. I can speak to this directly. As a new fire chief coming into Alaska, I experienced firsthand the delays and unnecessary time lag associated with EMS certification. We are also seeing the same challenges with new hires coming from the state, from out of state. These are qualified professionals who are ready to work, but administrative barriers delay their ability to provide care for our community. That directly impacts our ability to staff ambulances and maintain service levels. This is not about lowering standards. It's about removing unnecessary barriers that prevent qualified providers from getting to work in a timely manner. It is important to be very clear about this. Compact does not. It does not change Alaska's scope of practice. It does not change medical direction. It does not change how EMS agencies are regulated or operated. All EMS personnel working in Alaska would still be required to follow Alaska law, local protocols, and the direction of the local medical director. As a fire chief, maintaining that local control is critical, and this compact fully preserves it. What the compact does provide is flexibility. It gives us the ability to access qualified providers more quickly, particularly in times of need, as stated earlier, on wildland incidents, without waiting weeks or months for licensing processes. It also supports the continuity for military families and EMS professionals who move between states, which is an important workforce consideration. Another significant benefit is improved public safety through enhanced accountability. The compact includes real-time sharing of disciplinary actions across member states. This ensures that issues identified in one state are visible in another and strengthens oversight across the system. This compact also supports emergency and disaster response. In Alaska, we often deal with incidents where outside resources may be needed. The ability to bring in EMS personnel without administrative delay strengthens our readiness and response capability. I want to emphasize that this compact does not require agencies to change how they hire, credential, or deploy personnel. It simply gives us another tool. Each agency retains full authority to determine who they bring into their system and under what conditions. In my role, I'm focused on ensuring that we can continue to provide reliable, timely, and effective emergency medical care to our community we serve. The EMS Compact supports the mission by improving flexibility, strengthening accountability, and maintaining the standards we already have in place. For those reasons, I support Senate Bill 256 and encourage your considerations. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hatley. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, Chief Hatley, and perhaps this is a question better asked for someone else, but you mentioned wildland fire incidents. I had the opportunity to work as a wildland firefighter many years ago. I wasn't an EMT or a paramedic, and most of the guys I worked with I don't think were EMTs or paramedics. Has there been a change to the requirements to that, or are you talking about some subset of the wildland fire response?
I'm also on an incident management team. I'm on PNW2 out of the Northwest. I was division supervisor. When I first started, I was an EMT, a line EMT. That was assigned to hotshot crews and hand crews. And as a single resource EMT going into other agencies, other states, other counties, I had a Washington license, and when we went to wildland fires in Montana, we had to follow the Montana, and that was where we kind of got into some issues. Is Montana had a process, but it took 2 to 3 weeks to get certified, so I couldn't practice as an EMT from Washington State in Montana, and being on a wildland incident, and again a federal incident, I couldn't practice my skills on a wildland incident, and that would be the same thing that would happen here. If a large incident, we're bringing resources from out of state. And to be a certified EMT in the state, you have to have the credentials to practice. And without those credentials, you can't practice your skill set. So it hamstrings you as an EMT to provide care. Although that is the resource you're ordered, you can't practice. And that's one of the things I see with this bill would allow it, they can come right across like a driver's license. You come across a state and you can practice immediately, and especially in a wildland arena or any emergency that comes in, when we're needing help, we need help immediately. And again, like I say, the wildland incidents, we were always requesting EMS support, and that's where we would require that.
The follow-up, Mr. Chair.
So Senator Dunbar.
I got it. So there are certain EMS assets that are maybe working with the hotshots, but the assertion is not that we couldn't bring in hotshot crews or
other No. It's like just that. It's a support function for the EMS.
Okay, that makes more sense. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for Mr. Hatley? On the phone, also available for questions, is the State Emergency Services Training Coordinator, Brian Webb, and our state liaison from the Department of War, Tammy Peralt. Mr. Hatley, thank you for your presentation. Any questions for Mr. Webb or Ms. Peralt?
I have a question. When
you get sick. Senator Dunbar.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, are there additional invited testifiers?
Okay, yes, we've had some teams difficulties, but I just was given the sign from Mr. Bridges that we do have Mr. Donnie Woodyard available now via phone. Mr. Woodyard, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much. My name is Donnie Woodyard. I'm the Executive Director of the United States EMS Compact. Apologize for the technical connection issues, but thank you for the opportunity to speak. As you are reviewing the EMS Compact, I am speaking on behalf of the national office that administers it. So the EMS Compact is administered by a commission, and it's called the Interstate Commission for EMS Personnel Practice. As of right now, there are 25 states that have enacted the EMS Compact, and currently approximately 450,000 EMS personnel in the United States. The EMS Compact was formed out of a cooperative agreement with the Department of Homeland Security in 2011, when the Department of Homeland Security recognized they had both an operational defense, security, and disaster response barrier, and that is in the natural course of emergencies, EMS personnel need to operate on no notice across state lines. We also recognize that EMS is a highly mobile profession, and that in routine operations, EMS also crosses state lines. Out of that, the EMS Compact was formed, which was the second interstate compact agreement for personnel licensure in the United States. From a national perspective, the EMS Compact has been a federal priority through multiple bipartisan administrations. The initial cooperative agreement was with the Obama administration, and then through the Trump administration, Biden administration, and now the current Trump administration, the EMS Compact has been front and center as a national priority. It is part of the Rural Health Transformation Grant, and states actually receive additional bonus points for being part of the EMS Compact. From a deployment perspective, EMS personnel are using the compact by the thousands every single day, be it from wildland fire support through disaster response through routine operations. From an Alaska perspective, Alaska is what we would call compact ready, meaning that you currently use the same education standards for EMS personnel. You currently utilize the same national examination for EMS personnel, and you have all the other requirements in place today, apart from passing the legislation. The EMS Compact requires EMS personnel to affiliate with a local agency. Alaskans are never forced to utilize the compact, neither as an employer or an individual. Furthermore, there is no cost imposed to join the compact. The EMS Compact does not charge the individual, nor does it charge the state. While there is a provision for a state assessment, in the over 10 years that the EMS Compact has operated, that has never been enacted and would only be enacted if all the governor representatives and commissioners agreed. We do not see that being a need or a possibility. With that, the EMS Compact would welcome Alaska, and it would not only be the 26th state, but I believe that it would incredibly help as many of your EMS providers in Alaska routinely rotate between Alaska and the lower 48. This would reduce bureaucracy, increase public protection, and allow you to better serve citizens and be part of the national system. I'm happy to stand for any questions or clarifications.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodyard. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Woodyard. I'm wondering which EMS levels that we currently license in the state of Alaska would be licensed under this compact?
Yes, sir. So Alaska, as you may know, offers some levels that are both in the national system, and you have some Alaska-specific levels as well. Currently in Alaska, you have an emergency medical technician, you have a paramedic, and you have in between the two an advanced EMT. And all three of those levels can currently take and do take the National Registry of EMT certification as the basis for licensure. That is required by the compact. In addition to that, and Alaska is not necessarily unique in this aspect, you do have an additional level, and that is an Alaska EMT, where they can take an Alaska-specific EMT examination. That level would not qualify for the EMS compact because it does not utilize the national examination. However, there is nothing that would prohibit you from continuing that to meet the specific needs of Alaskan communities. Just know that that level would not have the multi-state privilege, but you would not have to stop or cease that. We just have to make sure that the naming convention is tracked in the database differently.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Woodyard. That's an interesting answer. And so I know in some other compacts, you really can't have sort of a state-specific license outside of the framework, but you're saying that we can maintain this Alaska specific EMT level, and perhaps that answers the question that I was going to ask next, which is, you had said that basically we had the same education standards and we already meet these standards. I had heard from practitioners that there are training requirements in the compact that Alaska does not currently reach. Is that, or at least certain practitioners in Alaska don't reach? Is that true?
Through the chair, no. Thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. The question may have been centered around the confusion of the Alaska only EMT level. As I mentioned, there is a mechanism for Alaska to keep that, as long as it is delineated as a separate licensure notification or status. So with that, you currently meet all the other requirements. Every day, individuals in Alaska complete EMT, advanced EMT, and paramedic training, and they take the National Registry exam. That is the requirement, and there is no requirements beyond that. So the majority of your personnel already meet that, and no additional changes are required.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
So the Alaska-only EMT level, which I assume is the concern this practitioner addressed to me, which is, we have folks out in rural Alaska, for example, that have difficulty meeting hours requirements for certain kinds of training. Can we keep that automatically? Is the mechanism to have us keep that already in the bill as written? Do we need to amend the bill? How do we make sure that we don't sort of leave some folks out?
Yes, Senator, and through the chair, we do not believe that there's any amendment required to the bill and would discourage any amendment to the bill. And talking this through with your Alaska EMS office, most of that is handled in administrative rule right now. And what we have recommended to them is just to ensure that there is a nomenclature difference on the license level issued. And I believe right now in Alaska that is called an EMT-1. We would recommend through the rulemaking process that Alaska, in the database purposes, would have an EMT-1 Alaska and maybe an EMT-1 National Registry. The scope of practice of the two could actually remain the same. We do not dictate or change the scope of practice. That is a state sovereignty issue, but there is no conflict as long as those are two discrete license your titles tracked in your system.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I think that's very helpful, and I will bring that back to the folks that are concerned about this. In our supporting documents, we have a rebuttal document from, I'm not sure who it's from exactly, but it's to the International Association of Firefighters. And my question is the IAFF still opposed to this compact? Nationally, I mean. I don't think the local folks have weighed in, but is the national IAFF still opposed to this?
And through the chair, and thank you for the grace of joining by teleconference, so I can't see the visual clues. But so I certainly cannot speak on behalf of the IAFF. That would not be appropriate for me to speak on. But I can provide on the record some important updates. The IAFF was part of the drafting process of the law. There was what I might refer to as a dark period when their views differed from the compact views. I did receive notice through official channels within the past 2 weeks that the IAFF is prepared to and anticipated to officially change their status to at minimum neutral later this year at their annual meeting. I can also say that the IAFF has been a very consistent participant in our compacts, especially over the past 2 years. At all of our public meetings and our government forums, they have provided meaningful impact on both our processes and administrative rules. We enjoy a very positive relationship with IAF nationally, and we work very hard to do that. I've also been told that in the past 2 weeks, IAF National did have some talking points that were 5 years outdated on their website, and those talking points have been deliberately removed, and I can confirm that I can no longer find those anti-talking points on their website. I also do know that National IAF leadership has encouraged me to provide their direct telephone numbers to any locals who would like to discuss the change of position and status and to have one-on-one discussions about how they are working with the government body of the commission in a very positive, collaborative way. So I believe that relationship has been restructured in a very positive way, even if some outdated material might still be present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Woodyard.
Mr. Woodyard, thank you. Are there any further questions for Mr. Woodyard? Hearing and seeing none, we have Mr. Justin Perkins, who has joined us as well. Mr. Perkins, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Please begin.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Perkins. I am the Executive Director for Interior Region EMS Council. I am also a licensed paramedic with 30 years of experience in EMS, both inside and outside of Alaska. I'll be providing testimony today representing myself and also as representative of Interior Region EMS Council. I'd like to express my strong support for Senate Bill 256, which would allow Alaska to join the EMS Compact. As I could use this time today to recite normal speaking points, I think I would better serve this if I spoke to you more on a personal level. So I won't address our complex regulatory barriers or lack of workforce mobility in Alaska. But I'm just going to tell you my personal story. So after working in EMS in Alaska for nearly 10 years, I attended paramedic school at UAF back in 2005. At that time, paramedic jobs outside of the fire departments and flight services were scarce, to say the least. Eventually, I left the state, but because I had my national registry certification, I was easily able to obtain a license in several other states, New Mexico, Colorado, Louisiana, Wyoming, to name a few. Most recently, I worked in Wyoming as a flight paramedic, which Wyoming is a compact state. I was able to get my Wyoming paramedic license within about 24 hours after applying. In that role, I frequently crossed state lines when flying into other compact states. I just kind of did my job. I didn't have to worry about navigating new regulations every time I crossed a borderline. That being said, one of the neighboring states, Montana, which is not a compact state, presented some challenges. Their licensing process is very, very similar to Alaska's. It took me over a month to get licensed there. Worse if I flew a patient or if I just flew in from Wyoming into Montana, picked up a patient, and then transferred to another neighboring state, Idaho or wherever, Utah. I then had to constantly switch operational gears and address the different regulatory bodies. So it really was inefficient for workflow. Didn't really make sense from a safety perspective dealing with patients. And it's really cumbersome. Okay. So bringing this back to Alaska, in October of this last year, I was offered a job here in Fairbanks. Given my initial training and licensure in Alaska, you would assume getting my license back would be a very easy process. It was not. Despite having immediate access to the state office of BMS through my position as regional director, I still took nearly 3 months to submit required paperwork, which included gathering affidavits of good standing from every state in which I had held a paramedic license previously. The list I gave you earlier was a short list. That was a major undertaking. Because of my position, I was able to fast-track my application, but I can't imagine had I been a normal applicant from out of state, that could have taken several months longer. So Alaska currently operates as an island, right? As a paramedic in Alaska, you have to have a physician sponsor. You have to have a sponsoring agency to get a license, but you can't get hired at an agency unless you have an Alaska license. It's this frustrating loop that keeps qualified people out. The current barriers to entry in EMS workforce are just kind of ridiculous. So from my perspective, there are a couple benefits to joining compact. First, rapid deployment of itinerant medics, right? During disasters, like large-scale wildfires, things like that, the compact allows licensed EMS professionals from other member states to work in Alaska almost immediately. This cuts out the layers of red tape that we currently have in a provisional license setup. It also allows for our remote communities to access traveling medics or others to seamlessly rotate in and fill gaps. Kind of bringing it back to that personal note, when I was flying down in Wyoming, the flight agency that I worked for also operates in Alaska, and it was incredibly frustrating getting open shifts at Alaska bases, knowing full well that I couldn't fill those voids. Even though I was qualified, that might have been overqualified to provide care in those communities, there was nothing that could be done. And then you could just see that those Alaska providers were having to pick up the slack, just adding to their fatigue and burnout of our rural providers and EMS clinicians is a real thing. I don't mean to digress. Let me get back to the compact. So another second point I would say is that our military families and military bases, here in the interior we have four bases, and they struggle to integrate with local agencies because of the burdensome and kind of cumbersome regulations surrounding licensure. They really don't participate in local agency events. They don't fall in line with state regulation. They follow federal protocols, federal regulation, and it's within their purview to do so, but it makes coordinating and interacting with other agencies very difficult. And with compact, that would allow military spouses as well as military service members to essentially start working in our communities basically upon arrival. And then the third point I want to make is that this compact doesn't really lower standards, right? In fact, it increases public safety by utilizing that coordinated database, which I'm sure Donnie mentioned, checking for disciplinary actions, ensuring all participating states meet high background checks in terms of, that regulation. And again, Donnie could speak better to that than I could. But from our perspective at Interior Region, it's absolutely worth embracing that higher standard. And I know that some agencies in Alaska see that as a barrier, but from our position in Interior Region, we see it as a positive. So in closing, again, I urge the committee to pass Senate Bill 256 to strengthen our emergency response infrastructure and break down these barriers to get qualified medics to the Alaskans that need them. I will remain on the line and are available if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perkins, for your testimony. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, I would like to note for the record that we have been joined by Senator Merrick online at 2:01 p.m. We hope that she is feeling okay. Any other questions for anyone online or the bill sponsor?
I have a question.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Senator Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for bringing this bill forward, because I know that it's a requirement for the Rural Health Transformation Program. And I was really pleased to hear testimony from the Juneau Fire Chief. But I'm just wondering, have you gotten any feedback from the Anchorage Fire Department? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson. For the record, Robert Myers, Senator for District Q. So we have not heard back from the Anchorage Fire Department just yet. We did introduce this just a little over a month ago. The folks that we had testify today from Interior EMS and from the Juneau Fire Department reached out to us specifically. We had not specifically reached out to fire departments across the state. We had had those ones come directly to us when they saw the legislation introduced.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Webb. Mr. Webb, I'm wondering if you have any concerns or clarification that you need about this compact and how it would affect how we do business here in Alaska with licensing EMS personnel.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. And for the record, my name is Brian Webb. I work in the Department of Health, Division of Public Health, in the Alaska Office of the EMS. And largely, I do not have issues with it. I would like to, if I could, clarify Senator Dunbar's questions that he had for Donnie Woodyard in regards to education standards and other things that are rural and our frontier EMS folks have. So if I may, I would like to be able to answer those questions.
Would you like Senator Dunbar to repeat the questions?
Through the chair, no, I'm fully cognizant of what the question is and what the answers are that he was asking for.
Would you like to respond now, sir?
Yes, I would.
As you like it.
And thank you. And one of the basic issues that were asked was was for the continuing education standards for relicensure. And just as a note, Alaska EMS has been under the National Continued Competency Program since 2016, and it was updated in 2025. And we still fall underneath that. So nationally, our continuing education standards for relicensure are exactly the same as the other states, because we all fall under that National Continued Competency Program. And also the National Registry of EMTs also falls under the guidance of the National Continued Competency Program. So it's actually all aligned. And when it comes to the issues in regards to scope and those other issues as far as training and such for initial licensing, the 2019 scope of practice update that was done nationally, Alaska fell under. And so we updated our scope to match the national scope. So we're equivalent. Doesn't matter if you're Alaska EMT-1 or National Registry EMT, it's all equivalent. And in 2021, the national EMS curriculum was updated, which forced Alaska in 2021 to do a large scope and statewide education update that lasted approximately 2 years. So now all of our current EMS clinicians at the EMT-1 level are all updated to the national standards, and any course that is registered with the state to be given must fall under those updated EMS curriculums from 2021. So those, I think, were the questions there. So there really isn't an effect on the education standards nor the continuing education for our EMS clinicians, whether they're urban or our frontier locations. And the Alaska Office of EMS also provides, through the Education Learning Management System for the Department of Health, approximately 150 hours of free continuing education online that an EMS clinician can take. And I will say that our community health aides, who are also EMT-1s, EMT-2s, or EMT-3s, they happen to be our power users for our learning management system. And they get most of their EMS education for relicensure right there online through our learning management system. So
I think that should answer the questions, and if Senator Dunbar has any further questions, I'd be happy to clarify anything else.
Thank you very much, Mr. Webb. We appreciate you being available today. Senator Myers, anything further before we set this bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just appreciate the committee's time on this bill.
Excellent. Well, I think it was sure helpful. I know we, I think, hopefully cleared up a lot of questions. And so we appreciate you bringing this forward. And we will consider it alongside of the other compacts that we are also considering. So thanks again. We will set Senate Bill 256 aside for further consideration at a future meeting and take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Back on the record now, it's 2:19 p.m. here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Up next, we have House Bill 110. Before we get to that, we'll do a little bit more scoping on what it is we're doing with lots of legislation dealing with compacts, as well as a little bit of scope of practice having to do with Title VIII, which is a lot of licensing under the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licenses. So the bill incorporates a number of things, which we'll hear about in a minute, but more to the theme of another bill that was just introduced today by the chairman to my left of the Health and Social Services Committee that deals with these compacts. So there are a bunch of us that will be looking at these things and getting eyes on them to make sure that the legislation that we are considering is going to be a good fit for Alaska, and also making sure that we are going to meet the needs and desires of the Rural Health Care Transformation Program. To that end, we have before members a CS of House Bill 110 that we would like to put on the table. It's quite lengthy, but don't let that intimidate you, as we can break it down into bite-sized pieces. We all know the best way to eat an elephant, of course, is one bite at a time, and that's what we'll do with some of these policies as well. Senator Gray Jackson, would you mind coming to give a brief explanation of the changes in the proposed CS that we will just have on the table, and we can take it up for consideration?
Brief at ease.
The record is 2:21 p.m. I'm sorry, I mislabeled my award-winning staffer, Conrad Jackson, who is here to give us a brief recap of the committee substitute, which we'll put on the table. We're not going to adopt it today. I won't ask you guys to do that, as we just got it. But, Mr. Jackson, thank you. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please begin your brief recap or brief introduction of the proposed CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. It is a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The CS before the, well, not really before the members, but on the table, version / G, makes three substantive changes to House Bill 110. We have inserted the language of three other pieces of legislation, and the first bite at the apple, and luckily we are starting from the clean end of the elephant. The first bite is House Bill 357, which establishes the scope of practice for occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants. The second bill is House Bill 352, which is establishing the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. And third, House Bill 362, which is establishing the respiratory care licensure. And, Mr. Chairman, I think, as you've noted, we have a number of folks online from these professions to speak to the importance of these compacts and the licensure. We also have Representative Hall in the room to speak to two of the three bills.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. We will call up the Honorable Representative Carolyn Hall. Representative Hall, thank you for joining us today. I wonder if you could please introduce the committee to the legislation that is contained in this CS that we're discussing.
Thank you very much. Chair Bjorkman, good afternoon, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. It is a pleasure to be here. Mr. Chair, do you want me to start with occupational therapy or with respiratory care licensure?
Let's start with respiratory care licensure.
Great. For the record, my name is Carolyn Hall. I represent House District 16, the West Anchorage neighborhoods of Turnigan, Spinard, and Sand Lake. So House Bill 362 regarding respiratory care licensure has to do with the fact that today respiratory therapists and the who are clinicians that manage ventilators, assist with life-saving procedures, and provide essential care to patients with respiratory failure are not required to hold a license. This creates a dangerous gap in oversight, accountability, and public protection. Alaska is the only state in the United States that does not professionally license respiratory care practitioners. So the purpose of the bill is to create a licensing process to increase patient safety and bring Alaska up to national standards. Patient safety must be a non-negotiable standard in our healthcare system. So the bill establishes licensing for respiratory care practitioners, aligning Alaska with every other U.S. state. It ensures that only qualified, credentialed professionals deliver this complex, high-risk care. Key provisions of the bill include implementing licensure for respiratory care practitioners in Alaska, a crucial step towards protecting patients and ensuring professional accountability. It defines a clear scope of practice in line with national standards, establishing biannual renewal and requiring continuing education to keep clinical skills up to date. It requires the registered respiratory therapist credential for new licensees, aligning with national standards and current health care needs. And it grandfathers existing certified respiratory therapists working in the state, recognizing their service while maintaining a high standard of care. Respiratory care practitioners manage some of the most technically complex and life-critical tasks in patient care, especially in intensive care units, emergency departments, and during public health emergencies, such as the pandemic we recently endured. Without licensing, there is no formal way to ensure these providers meet minimum qualifications or to protect the public from negligence or misconduct. So the content that is in this bill is a regulatory update for sure, but more importantly, it is a vital patient safety reform. It protects patients, modernizes our healthcare system, and reaffirms our commitment to high-quality professional care for Alaskans.
Thank you very much, Representative Hall. Are there any questions for members about this portion of the bill? You can find this portion of the bill on pages 2 and 3. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the reasons for this omnibus has to do with complying with certain parts of the Rural Health Transformation Fund. I don't recall respiratory care being discussed in the plan, but I don't know the plan chapter and verse. Is this distinct from the RHTP, or is this included in the state's plan to meet the RHTP?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I am not fluent with the RHTP, but my understanding is that the respiratory care licensure is separate from the policy commitments that were made in the RHTP, but I'm willing to request a lifeline so that somebody can possibly correct me.
My understanding is Rep. Hall is correct. This policy choice just has not been elected by the state of Alaska, and we are indeed a significant outlier, the last holdout, if you will, in not licensing respiratory care therapists. Currently, insurance covers this type of practice and the care provided by these practitioners, so it would not incur additional cost drivers to insurance plans if we adopt it. Its inclusion here in this bill, I really felt, was a good governance type of thing to make sure that we are licensing people appropriately in our state, and as well as looking out for patients who go to these practitioners for quality care, which is why it's included. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say that this bill was brought to my attention, or the possibility of this bill was brought to my attention in the fall of last year by respiratory care therapists. They asked for it. They want it. They recognize that it is a significant gap in the healthcare industry when it comes to all 49 other states being licensed, and Alaska is not. And in fact, one of the concerns that they shared with me was that during the pandemic, there were bad actors who were licensed outside. They ran afoul of their license at XYZ state. And so they ended up coming up to Alaska to practice because they did not need a license. And my understanding is that that did not go necessarily very well for patient care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions for this item's sponsor? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we'll go to some invited testifiers on this issue. First up, we have Angela Euler. Ms. Euler.
Good afternoon, Chair. Oh, yep. Can you hear me?
We can, ma'am. Thank you very much for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Angela Euler, and I am a registered respiratory therapist here in the state of Alaska. So I would just like to thank you for having this invited testimony. I, again, am a registered respiratory therapist and the president of the Alaska Society for Respiratory Care. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of the language in the committee substitute establishing licensure for respiratory care practitioners in our state. Respiratory therapists play a critical role in caring for Alaskans across the lifespan, from premature infants in the NICU to trauma patients in the emergency department to individuals with chronic lung disease or those that are requiring mechanical ventilation. We are often at the bedside during the most vulnerable moments of a patient's life. Currently, Alaska is the only state without licensure for respiratory therapists. State licensure is an important step toward ensuring consistent standards in education, competency, accountability, and professional oversight. Licensure protects Alaskans by verifying that those providing complex cardiopulmonary care have met nationally recognized educational and credentialing requirements and are held to clear standards of practice. This language, was carefully drafted using scope of practice language from other states and aligned with national best practices. It does not expand the role of respiratory therapists beyond what we are already currently trained and nationally credentialed to do. Rather, it formalizes standards and provides a regulatory framework that supports safe, high-quality care. Respiratory therapists practice under physician direction and medical orders. We are integral members of the healthcare team, collaborating closely with physicians, nurses, and other professionals to deliver evidence-based care. Licensure does not change this collaborative model. It strengthens it by ensuring that all practitioners meet uniform standards. I would like to highlight an important part of this legislation, the grandfather clause for currently practicing certified respiratory therapists in the state of Alaska. Our aim is not to restrict or displace anyone who is currently practicing in good standing in our state. It's very important to us that those serving Alaskan communities today can continue to do their roles. This legislation offers a pathway for current CRTs to attain licensure without disrupting their employment, acknowledging their experience and service. At the same time, we believe it is important for Alaska to align with the rest of the nation, where the profession is steadily moving towards registered respiratory therapist standard as minimum credential for entry into practice. Establishing licensure allows us to both honor our current workforce and thoughtfully transition toward nationally recognized standards that reflect the increasing complexity of respiratory care. Patient safety is our primary concern. Licensure provides transparency, accountability, and a mechanism to address concerns should they arise. It just assures Alaskans that the person managing their ventilator, assisting with airway emergencies, or delivering life-sustaining therapies have met rigorous professional standards. The respiratory care practitioner language in the CS focuses on protecting Alaskan patients. It aims to align Alaska with national standards and ensure our state continues to provide safe, high-quality respiratory care. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Euler, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we will go next to Miriam O'Day. Ms. O'Day, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Miriam O'Day, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs with the American Association for Respiratory Care. We represent more than 130,000 respiratory therapists nationwide, and we thank you for the opportunity to provide strong support for legislation that establishes licensure for respiratory therapists in the state of Alaska. As you heard from Ms. Euler, this legislation is fundamentally about patient safety and public protections. Respiratory therapists are highly trained allied health professionals who provide life-sustaining pulmonary care across the lifespan. And today, Alaska is home to an estimated 700 to 800 practicing respiratory therapists, many of whom serve in geographically isolated settings where access to specialized care is limited. And in these environments, respiratory therapists often practice with a high degree of autonomy, making standardized qualifications and oversight essential. As you've heard today, Alaska remains the only state in the nation without licensure for respiratory therapists. And without a uniform statutory framework, you are not ensuring minimum education and training standards. You're not ensuring verification of national credentials, ongoing competency through continuing education, and a formal mechanism for disciplinary oversight. Licensure establishes clear, enforceable standards to ensure that the only qualified individuals are permitted to deliver complex respiratory care. In every other state, these services are provided by licensed professionals who meet nationally recognized standards, including credentials from the National Board for Respiratory Care, the NBRC. I will note that employers in your state who employ respiratory therapists often confirm their credentials are in good standing. Establishing licensure in Alaska would align the state with national best practices, strengthen patient protections through formal oversight, provide clarity and consistency for healthcare employers, and enhance the workforce quality and accountability. Importantly, the absence of licensure creates a vulnerability. Without a regulatory framework, Alaska risks becoming a destination for individuals who may not meet the standards required in other states. Licensure closes that gap and reinforces public trust. For Alaska's most vulnerable populations, including your rural residents, Alaska Native communities, seniors, and children, this legislation ensures that the professionals managing their breathing meet verified, consistent standards of care. When a patient can't breathe, nothing else matters. Families trust that the clinicians at the bedside are qualified to act quickly, safely, and effectively. Licensure helps ensure that trust is well placed. And for all of these reasons and the reasons that Ms. Euler stated, the AARC respectfully urges passage of this legislation. Thank you for your leadership and your commitment to protecting the health and safety of all Alaskans. I have written testimony I would be happy to submit for the record.
Ms. O'Day, that would be most excellent. Labor and Commerce, we always are appreciative of written testimony, and I know that our recording secretary, Ms. Carrie Tupo, is as well. So anytime that someone would like to submit written testimony, that would be most welcome at our email address, slac@akleg.gov. Are there any questions for Ms. O'Day? Seeing and hearing none, wondering if we could chat with Director Sylvan Robb a little bit from the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licenses about how licensing these professionals will work. Director Robb, thank you for being here with us today. Could you just talk us through the mechanics of how licensing these folks will work and how your office will assist in that process?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. The licensing of respiratory therapists will proceed as many of our other non-boarded programs, so programs that are overseen entirely by the division, happens. Once this legislation passes, we will establish any regulations needed. Additionally, develop application forms for individuals who are applying for a respiratory therapist license. Our fiscal note for this bill in particular does indicate that we would add a licensing examiner to our staff. That does come with a cost, of course, and that individual would be the person who would then review the applications and the materials that come in for these individuals. So typically the things that are required are, the application, they need to pay the fee. They also need to provide directly from their educational institution proof of having graduated, proof of having passed an exam, and the other materials required. So we examine those, ensure that they meet the statutory and regulatory requirements, and if they do, then they would be issued a license.
Excellent. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might not be seeing it, the fiscal note you mentioned. I think I just don't have a packet for whatever reason. Approximately how much money is it?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar. So the fiscal note would be for the House bill that Representative Hall was speaking about. And if you'll give me one moment. So it's the fiscal note for House Bill 362. And it has a cost in the first year of $46,100 and then in subsequent years, $41,600. And that is, we are reclassifying an existing office assistant into a licensing examiner, as well as a couple other costs related to the regulations project. But that's primarily what the cost is.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And remind me, the are there any additional costs associated with the board or additions to a board to manage this, or is that, can it be absorbed by an existing board?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, excuse me. this bill does not establish a board for this profession, so there are currently 24 programs that are regulated entirely by the division. This is one of those. And it is worth noting, Senator, that the costs we're speaking of would be covered by licensing fees. So all of that is receipt-supported services. So no UGF in the mix.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question regarding specifically licensing fees. Would respiratory therapists, would they be grouped together with other medical professionals in a pool of licensing fee payers, or would they be in their own separate pool?
To the chair, they would be in their own pool. So AS 0801065 requires us to establish licensing fees for each profession and set those to cover the cost of regulating that profession. We can't say that based on other professions that don't have boards that are sort of a similar size of what we understand the number of respiratory therapists to be. Fees have ranged 100 to 325 for the two-year period. Of course, we do track costs, and so their actual fee amount will be set based on the actual cost to regulate respiratory therapists.
Understood. Well, that makes good sense. Okay. Thank you, ma'am. Any further questions for Director Robb at this time? Very good. We will go now to occupational therapists. Representative Hall, whenever you are ready, you can give us an explanation as to what is happening with occupational therapists. If folks want to turn to the chapter and verse in the bill before us, the scope of practice for occupational therapists begins on page 49.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Carolyn Hall, representative for House District 16. The language that is in HB 347 regarding occupational therapy care was also brought to my attention in my office by stakeholders and has undergone extensive stakeholder engagement. But maybe I should start first with what occupational therapy care is. And occupational therapy helps people whose ability to participate in the activities of daily living is impeded by disability or pain caused by illness, birth defect, aging, or injury. Whereas physical therapy focuses on improving mobility, strength, and a range of motion to restore physical function, occupational therapy helps patients gain independence in performing daily life tasks, such as dressing, eating, or working, by adapting tasks and environments. Alaska Statute Chapter 84 currently describes the scope of practice of physical therapists, but provides limited reference to what an occupational therapist does, describing their function as to help patients cope. So in the bill, it provides a scope of practice for occupational therapists, incorporating established clinical practice, educational and national standards. Without this update, Alaskans are at risk to receive a narrower level of care defined by outdated wording rather than by modern standards of practice. We worked closely with Alaskan occupational therapists to tailor this bill to describe how the therapists not only help a patients adjust, but also restore, rehabilitate, and enhance function after a change in their physical capabilities. The bill does not expand the scope of practice beyond national norms. Instead, it provides clear scope language intended to improve access and timeliness of care by removing ambiguity that can slow referrals and treatment. Expediting the referral process can hasten rehabilitation after surgery or stroke. So what is in the language in front of you is a practical modernization of Alaska's occupational therapy statute that will strengthen the ability of Alaskans to remain safe and independent in their homes, schools, workplaces, and communities. Additionally, Mr. Chair, the occupational therapists, as I mentioned previously, they have undergone extensive stakeholder outreach, in particular with their physical therapy colleagues, and there's extensive letters of support that support that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hall. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we will go to some invited testifiers on this topic. First up is Dr. Jean Kekut. Dr. Kekut, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee, my name is Jean Kekut, and I have been a licensed occupational therapist for 31 years and practiced in Alaska for 25. I'm here in support of HB 110, used to be 347, because Alaska's current occupational therapy statute is outdated and does not reflect modern healthcare practice. Right now, our law emphasizes helping patients cope with limitations, but it does not clearly recognize our role in restoring and rehabilitating function. That gap creates regulatory confusion and places Alaska out of alignment with national standards. In a healthcare system already facing workforce shortages and access challenges, unclear scope language creates unnecessary barriers to timely care. In a rural state like ours, delays in rehabilitation can mean prolonged disability, delayed return to work, and higher long-term costs. Patients recovering from injury need clear access to restorative care, and providers need clarity in statute to practice safely and confidently within their training. HB 110 addresses that gap. It updates outdated language so Alaska patients are not underserved simply because our statute has not kept pace with healthcare evolution. This bill is about ensuring that Alaskans have access to modern, evidence-based occupational therapy care consistent with national standards. Thank you, and I respectfully ask for your support.
Thank you, Dr. Kekut. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go next to Dr. Audra Yuchin. Dr. Yuchin, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Audra Yuchin. I'm an occupational therapist. I'm calling from Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I am testifying in strong support of HB 110, previously 347, because Alaska's occupational therapy statute does not, it no longer reflects how care is delivered today. And occupational therapy is not just about helping people cope, as was said in the previous couple of presentations. It's really about restoring function, developing skills, and helping people return to meaningful roles in their life. When the law doesn't reflect this, it creates confusion. Again, reiterating what's been previously said, it limits access to care and it can delay recovery. And in a state like Alaska, access is already limited. We have, as you know, geographical complications, and we're a big state. And so these delays have real consequences. And updating the scope of practice will ensure that patients can receive timely and appropriate care, and that providers are able to practice within their level of training. It does allow us to bring our practice language and our scope in line with national standards, and it does give us the ability to practice, again, at the top of our license and with the standard of care that is common, I would say, nationally, and for what we've been educated to do. Specifically, I work with brain injury recovery, both children and adults, and functional vision, and I guarantee that people who come to see me are not interested in having me help them cope with those deficits. All of them are very motivated to return to work, return to their roles, you know, being with their family, and this is important in Alaska, that we get people back to doing the things that they, that are meaningful and that they love. So I appreciate your consideration and your time in allowing me to present today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Yuchin. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, I have one question, Ms. Yuchin. Could you? I'm having trouble just tracking. So what is limiting? What specifically is limiting with our scope of practice definitions now that you will be able to do in the future under this new language?
Sure. Through the chat, I apologize. I'm a little nervous.
It's okay. You're doing great.
So I don't know the exact language. I think I'm supposed to say through this pair. I apologize. So my experience is that the current language is limiting in that it does not define and recognize the role of occupational therapy, and I would say the essential role in occupational therapy, and our ability to restore and help people develop skills and rehabilitate skills that have been lost. So it does not align with, again, national practice standards. There's a few other points of clarification that have been made with the regulatory language, and I would respectfully defer to Jean or potentially another professional who is intimately involved in that very specific language change that updated that language. But it does not clarify or define the role that we have in restoring function and restoring independence, and actually being part of the rehabilitative process. It's basically, if you came to me and said, you know, you had a stroke or your loved one had a stroke and you were not able to speak well or use your right hand, the language indicates that an OT is there to help you live with that deficit rather than help restore the function in your life so that you can get back to living. And that's what we're trained to do. That's what our education reflects. Is that we are about restoring function, rehabilitating skills,
helping kiddos who have never developed a skill learn skills when developmental skills don't occur as expected, don't develop as expected. We teach new skills, so that's habilitative. And so it's important that we update the language to reflect what we're actually doing and how essential it is. Not doing so does limit care, and it does impact our ability to provide appropriate care for the people in our state. And this is, again, this is not in line with the national standard, and it's not in line with descriptive of what we are educated and capable of doing when we come out as practitioners.
Okay, thank you. I think I understand, but I want to make sure that I'm clear, and I'll use like a hypothetical here. So if I get hurt and I hurt my shoulder and I can't move my shoulder, my mobility is severely limited, and I need to go see a physical therapist or an occupational therapist to help me with my shoulder, what currently under the law would you be able to do to help me with my shoulder, and what would you be able to do in the future if this passes?
And that was to me. Apologies. This is Audra. That was to me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. The update in the scope of practice, I believe, is really about providing clarity to and defining the role and the scope of what we actually do and the skills that we actually bring to the rehabilitative process. And I certainly, again, I would like to defer to anyone here testifying that has better language or is better able to articulate some of the things that I might be stumbling over myself saying here. But
no worries. Yeah, that's fine. We'll go to Dr. Kekut.
Okay.
Yep, no worries. Thank you for being here today.
Through the chair, this is Jean Kekut, and thank you for that question. I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Yes, ma'am, we can.
Okay, great. I agree with Audra that it is the scope of practice is mainly to clarify the language of what we are providing to patients. So in answer to your question, Senator Bjorkman, it was we would be able to provide your shoulder rehab at this point, and probably that isn't the best example of the barriers that we might encounter. I think there are more barriers when you're talking about rural care and having less providers to provide certain types of rehab, and because of that, I guess with the rural, I guess I can't explain exactly how there are less people providing care in the rural setting, so there is language in our scope of practice that includes the occupational therapy assistants, and it gives them the power to be able to perform occupational therapy services in the rural communities in addition to Anchorage and some of the larger communities.
Okay, thank you. All right. We appreciate you all being available to testify to this legislation today. We are going to consider other parts of this draft CS at a future meeting, likely after the Easter break, just so folks are kind of aware of the plan. As I mentioned before, Senator Gray Dunbar has similar legislation before his committee, which is good so that as many people as possible can get eyes on it and are familiar with all of it, as it is specialized, detailed, and integral to the rural healthcare transformation program. So that is what we'll do. Representative Hall, thank you for being here, available today. I know you had to miss another meeting to come and commune with us here in Senate Labor and Commerce, so we're thankful that you were here. We'll set House Bill 110 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. The committee will meet again on Friday of this week when we will take up Senate Bill 124, Nurse Licensure Compact, as well as SJR 28, supporting J1 and H1B visa programs. As there is no further business to come before the committee today, we are adjourned at 2:59 p.m.